Welcome to Shattering Myths, a program devoted to the most important and indeed the fastest growing segment of society. To those who know that the world's political, government, religious, media, military, and economic institutions are corrupt, all of them, that they are counterproductive, that they cannot be fixed. Our mission, therefore, is to look behind the headlines, to know who is working against our interest, to even understand why they're doing so. Because exposing and condemning errant and treacherous schemes, no matter if they're political, patriotic, or religious, isn't hateful. It's the most compassionate, caring, and indeed wise thing we can do. In our second hour, sometimes in our third, we use evidence and reason to explore the Torah. It means teaching. It does not mean law. It's not a religious book. It is a book of guidance because its enriching and empowering covenant provides the only reliable answer for you and your family. Our phone number, if you'd like to participate in this discussion, is toll-free, 877-300-7645. And while we're on the nature of this program, there is a significant group of listeners who have joined together for the express purpose of helping to syndicate Shattering Myths. Right now, the listenership of Shattering Myths is based online, but you can play a significant role in broadening the program's reach if you're willing to participate in its syndication. And in the case of Shattering Myths, we're not going to do this as a group of professionals. Lord knows the I shouldn't use that term. Yah knows that I don't claim to be professional. We're doing it as a group of people who are just interested in communicating information that very few people are willing to say, that most people need to hear, that is beneficial to all of us. And that the more people who hear the news as it's presented from God's perspective, from the perspective that human institutions are not reliable and they are actually counterproductive, and then who have the opportunity to listen to the covenant presented as it's presented in the Torah are going to benefit from it. So if you would like to play a role as just someone who enjoys this program, who benefits from the program, who thinks others would as well, then we'd encourage you to drop us a line. I can be reached at yada@yadaya.com, and we will put you together with the group that is embarking on this mission. And there's literally nothing you need to know other than a genuine enthusiasm for the program and a desire for others to be able to listen to it is more than sufficient. Turning to the news, an article caught my eye. It reads as follows. The head of a nationwide sheriff's coalition is calling on Vermont's law enforcement officers to defy three controversial gun control measures passed by the Burlington voters 3 weeks ago. Now, it's not very often that you would have law enforcement telling fellow law enforcement officers that they should deliberately defy a new law. But in this case, what they're doing is reasonable. And it's really necessary in this case because the Supreme Court of the United States won't deal with this issue. Every year they just pass by because they know there is no justification for any gun control legislation in this country. The U.S. Constitution is clear. The people have the right to keep and to bear arms. And the arms that are considered appropriate for the people to keep and bear are the kind that would be used in a military, in militias. And this was written into the Constitution for a number of reasons. The first is that the Founding Fathers did not want to have a standing military. An established military was anathema to them. They thought that there would be nothing more corrupting, nothing more taxing, nothing more freedom depriving, nothing more truth robbing in a country than an established military. And yet the established military of the United States is larger than the rest of the world's militaries combined. They wanted the people to be armed so that it would make the invasion of the nation essentially impossible. And if the Second Amendment of the U.S. Constitution were upheld, if there were no restrictions on the arms that people could have and bear, we would not need a military. We would be guaranteed a freedom. It would be impossible for any nation to invade and occupy the United States. That's all we need to do. We could eliminate not only the $650 billion that has been squandered year after year on the military, but we could also eliminate all of the freedoms that have been robbed as a result of having a military. We could even keep the United States from constantly engaging in counterproductive invasions, especially like the last two in Iraq and Afghanistan, where both bad situations were made much worse. So in this case, the sheriff's coalition is telling fellow and law enforcement officers, don't do what you've been asked to do. It's unconstitutional. You have a greater call to duty than a popular vote. Your greater call to duty is to the Constitution. Here's the quote. It reads, sheriffs have a constitutional duty. Constitutional should have been capital C. It was lowercase c, unfortunately. Duty to refuse to comply with such ordinances, said Richard Mack, president of the Constitutional Sheriffs and Peace Officers Association. We're seeing sheriffs in New York oppose the SAFE Act and Governor Cuomo. If we have sheriffs in New York doing this, how much more would we have sheriffs doing it, or should we have sheriffs doing it in Vermont? You know, New York, Washington, D.C. are examples of states and districts that are way out of whack constitutionally, where it's a felony to observe the U.S. Constitution. Now, I'm not telling you the Constitution is the perfect document. I'm not here telling you that it is in any way inspired, but it is the basis of order in the United States. When it is violated without amendment, as grotesquely as it is related to the Second Amendment, and in place of it, we have this gargantuan military apparatus that Americans have no hope. So long as they're willing to continue to go down this path, there is no chance for this nation. Now, I'm not telling you again that there's chance for this nation that we can resolve our issues if we just simply resolve the issues related to gun control and the Second Amendment. That's one of many, many thousands of things that would have to be resolved. And quite frankly, it isn't going to happen. But I just want to point out how this one issue, among many others, is so troubling. On March 4th, the article reads, Burlington voters, this would be Burlington, Vermont, they joined a push by elected officials throughout the northeastern states to enact stiffer gun control measures. By a 2-to-1 margin, they banned the carry of firearms in bars and restaurants. Did you see any ability to do that and be in compliance with the U.S. Constitution? You know, the right to keep and bear arms can't be infringed. It authorized police to confiscate guns used during, well, not used during domestic disputes, just to confiscate guns during domestic disputes. If you're called for a domestic dispute and somebody has a gun in their home, even if they're not using the gun, even if the gun is unloaded, even if the gun is locked up, it has to be confiscated. And rather than bearing arms, all firearms that are owned legally have to be locked up in the home or seized. It also requires the owners of what's called an assault rifle, which is the very kind of weapon that is envisioned by the Second Amendment, has to be turned over to the government. So that, you know, only the government can be armed. And you think that you're going to achieve freedom under those circumstances? Good luck with that. It's astonishing, this quote reads, that people are so cavalier about violating the Second Amendment, Mack said. Burlington City Council sounds like they are just following the trend to do things that are entirely unconstitutional, and to go around the sheriffs and to go around the laws, to subvert the laws, to disobey the laws. You know, why is it that elected officials who are elected based upon the overall republic and its constitution think that they're empowered to violate the Constitution? At that point, you do not have the rule of law. At that point, you only have the whims of those who are empowered. Speaking of the whims of those who are empowered, it's extraordinarily sad to read what's continuing to happen in Egypt. Now, I'm not going to infer in any shape or way that there is a good course of action in Egypt. That country is so poisoned by Islam, there is no hope. But listen to this. Today, an Egyptian court, we should put court in quotations because this is a court governed by Sharia, and the moral code of Sharia is the antithesis of anything that a reasonable, rational person, that a moral person would consider good. You know, in Sharia, rape is okay. In fact, the victim of a rape is prosecuted, not the perpetrator. Incest is just fine in Sharia. So is pedophilia. Kidnapping, perfectly acceptable in Sharia. Killing, A-okay, so long as you can justify the killing based upon Islamic grounds. Anyway, the Egyptian court, put in quotation marks, sentenced 529 members of the outlawed Muslim Brotherhood to death and other offenses based upon what they claimed was the murder of others. Now, in this particular case, those they killed were most often shooting at them. But here is the government of Egypt going to kill the opposition. This is an opposition that garnered 70% of the votes in the last election between them and the most Salaf of political parties. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. A little over a year ago, the Muslim Brotherhood and the Salaf, Salaf means ancestor, party and parties in Egypt, the most conservative Muslim parties, won almost 70% of the vote. A year later, they're ousted by a military dictator. But not only that, they are targeted as terrorists, hunted down, and killed, both by the army, who now fires live ammunition into protests, and by the court system, which accuses members of this religious political party of being murderers. I mean, think of that. Now, you're in the United States. And imagine that collectively the Democratic and, let's use the Republican side. Let's say the Republican Party gets 48% of the vote at the next election. And the Tea Party is counted separately and they get another 8 or 9. And then the Libertarians, who are also for a lesser use of government, receive 4 or 5 more. And you decide after those elections that the people elected by those three parties should all be thrown in jail. They should all have mock trials. They should be executed. And worse, anybody who worked on behalf of those political parties, they should be thrown in jail. Anyone associated with them should be thrown in jail and should have a mock trial and should be executed. And in the meantime, the military would take control of the country. That's what you have in Egypt. That's not to say that the Muslim Brotherhood was good for Egypt. They weren't. That's the Muslim Brotherhood, is the wellspring from which virtually every Sunni Islamic terrorist organization has been born. It is as bad as any organization on earth. It's why President Obama never should have given a speech embracing, condoning, uplifting Islam at the very place the Muslim Brotherhood was born. Not only in Cairo, but Al-Azhar University in Cairo. And now you have in Egypt, the military government, the leader of whom, Sisi, was trained by the United States, a military that is supported entirely by the United States. The entire Egyptian military budget is paid by the United States. You look at what they spend annually on their military and what the United States provides as military assistance, they match. And now this military in Egypt has rendered a political party, a religious political party that garnered between them and the Salafists almost 70% of the vote illegal, killing anyone who is associated with it. It's astonishingly sad in a way, but it's also amazingly revealing that Islam could corrupt a society to the point where you're scratching your head saying, is this a good thing or is this a bad thing? Or is this a less bad thing than the bad thing of having the military do these kinds of things? And where the only options are very, very bad and much worse than that. It should be an eye-opener for folks that we ought not be sending several billion dollars in aid and military aid, military weaponry, to Egypt. That we ought not be giving speeches at the birthplace of religious institutions that gave rise to Islamic terrorism, as President Obama did. That we ought not think that it is possible to deal with those who are poisoned by Islam. Look at the situation. It's as abysmal as anything that you could possibly imagine. Family members stood outside the courthouse screaming after the verdict, the biggest mass death sentence ever handed down in Egypt. Turmoil has deepened since the army overthrew Egypt's first freely elected president, Mohamed Morsi, of the Muslim Brotherhood in July. Security forces have killed hundreds of Brotherhood members in the streets and have arrested many thousands more, confiscating their files, destroying their offices, throwing the participants in jail. And those they haven't jailed, they have killed. Welcome to the new Egypt, the Egypt that America is supporting both sides of the conflict. Welcome back to Shattering Messages. Michelle Obama and her daughters are gallivanting around China on taxpayer money, kind of a hypocritical move for a president that condemned automakers for flying their jets to meet with him when he summoned them to Washington early in his presidency. But it's okay for the Queen of America to take the princesses to China for a vacation at U.S. taxpayer expense. Well, he is now on the other side of the world. He is in Europe. And because the press just loves him, and it's amazing, though, that the Associated Press would put the reality of what he is being credited for deep in the article, since Obama wiretapped some 300 journalists with the Associated Press. But nonetheless, let's let bygones be bygones. The president is being heralded as a great peacemaker. This headline is The Hague, Netherlands, Associated Press. Japan will hand over to the United States more than 315 kilograms, 700 pounds, of weapons-grade plutonium and a supply of highly enriched uranium. a victory for U.S. President Barack Obama's efforts to secure nuclear materials around the world. Quote, this is a very significant nuclear security pledge and activity, end quote, U.S. Energy Secretary Ernst Monitz told reporters in The Hague. Quote, the material will be transferred to the United States for transformation into proliferation-resistant forms, end quote. Well, first of all, you might wonder, what in the world was Japan doing with weapons-grade plutonium? Well, Japan was given the weapons-grade plutonium from the United States and Britain in the 1960s. It was earmarked for research. The summit was part of a process that was launched by Obama in 2009, and it focuses on nuclear weapons, but also on efforts to reduce and secure nuclear material stockpiles to prevent them from falling into the hands of terrorists, who are, of course, always ambiguous. We never say the truth, which is that 99% of terrorism is perpetrated by fundamentalist Muslims and therefore into the hands of Muslims who could potentially use them to fashion a weapon or dirty bomb. Now, read the rest of this to you and you tell me where you think the hypocrisy may have eased its way into this discussion. In addition to the weapons-grade material Japan is giving back, it will continue to maintain a stockpile of 9.3 tons of lesser-grade plutonium that could easily be weaponized by a country of Japan's sophistication. Perhaps in a matter of months, that material could present an attractive target for terrorists. Additionally, Japan's new Rokkasho nuclear plant, due to come online this year, is capable of producing almost that much more, another 9.3 tons of plutonium per year. Now, if we just take what Japan still has, it gave up 700 pounds of plutonium. And it has 18,600 pounds of plutonium, and by this time next year, we'll have 36, almost 37, in fact, over 37,000 pounds of plutonium. Right now, 700 is a product of 18,600 is about 3%. They kept 97%. They kept 3%. Big whoop, huh? Why would you make an announcement other than to flatter the President of the United States, other than to make it sound like he accomplished something worthwhile? Giving up 3% and announcing to the world that 97% is still there and that you're going to have twice that amount in a matter of a year is hardly a victory. If that's winning, if getting 3% right and 97% wrong is winning, today, I guess we are the product of our education system and outcome-based math. Rather surprising. By the way, with a dirty bomb, plutonium would not be a good choice. The daughter products of nuclear reactions and nuclear power plants, other than plutonium, would be a much better choice, and they're much more prolific. They are available far more universally. And that's because plutonium has a very long half-life. Plutonium is effective in a nuclear bomb that is either fissionable or fusionable. If it's fissionable, you break apart the plutonium to create a fission reaction, as was one of the two nuclear bombs dropped on Japan. But in a fusion bomb, you still have to have a fission reaction. It's the fission reaction that creates the fusion reaction of hydrogen. But because the half-lives are so long on plutonium, for example, even uranium-235, a dirty bomb would be much more successfully created out of the daughter products of nuclear energy that have much shorter half-lives. Speaking of hypocrisy, this report from Reuters. It begins, Qatar by some pronunciation, Q-A-T-A-R, is backing for Syrian rebels, widely regarded as jihadists, might appear a diplomatic liability at a time when global alarm is about Al-Qaeda being on the rebound. But that is not the way things are viewed in the Gulf state, which is proud of its self-declared campaign to back Arab Spring revolts against autocratic rule. Now, there's two issues here. Qatar is a dictatorial monarchy. How in the world can the emir of Qatar say that it's appropriate for him to weaponize revolts against autocratic rule? He's an autocrat. He's a dictator. The emir of Qatar, Hamad bin Khalifa Al Thani, has held absolute power since the formation of his personal fiefdom, of his personal estate, in 1971. Constitutionally, which is a constitution that he himself wrote, the rights to rule is passed on through the Al Thani family. It's not subject to people's opinions or vote. The constitution is fundamentalist Islam and absolute compliance with Sharia law. The emir answers to no one other than Allah and is constrained only by Sharia. Now, Sharia law authorizes dictatorship. Sharia law is universally opposed to freedom, to democracy, to free will, to choice. The emir, therefore, is a dictator. All political parties in Qatar are banned. There is no electoral system. And yet, here he presents himself and his government in a campaign to back Arab Spring revolts against autocratic rule. How can anybody even say something like that? How can Reuters print something like that without screaming, "Are you kidding me? What's wrong with you? That's pure hypocrisy. You're a dictator." The second part of this is there's alarm that Al-Qaeda is on the rebound. Now, how's that possible? Of the Al-Qaeda that existed, that has been associated with 9/11, and only indirectly so. Osama bin Laden was aware of 9/11. He didn't plan it. Planning for 9/11 was conceived entirely by Rumpf's Janssen, that he alone, the very man that coordinated and planned and perpetrated the first bombing of the World Trade Center, Rumpf Janssen, was the mastermind of 9/11. On his computers in the Philippines, the FBI and the Philippine government was made fully aware of Rusi Yanza's attempt to train Muslims in American flight schools and then fly them into the World Trade Center, the Pentagon, and the U.S. Capitol. It's his plan. But anyway, Al-Qaeda was at least aware of it, made aware of it, because of a relationship between Ramzi Yousef and Sheikh Khalil Mohammed, family members, intermarriage, that sort of thing. But of the original crew that was the perpetrators in association with 9/11, there's only one left, only one. Ayman al-Zawahiri. So how in the world can Al-Qaeda be on the rebound? It's just the stupidity of the statement. It's mind-boggling. What's on the rebound is Islamic fundamentalism. The Arab Spring has not been about freedom or democracy or choice or or even Arab. Certainly hasn't been about a birth of anything. It's not about spring. It's about the revival of fundamentalist Islam. And the underpinnings of this were noticeable around the world for about a decade. Every time a vote was taken, every time a poll was taken in any country where Islam represented a majority of the population, between 65 and 70% of those who were polled, of those who voted, cast their adherence towards the most fundamentalist Islamic candidate. For example, in the areas called the Palestinian territories, when given the chance to cast their vote, 70% of the mythical people known as the Palestinians, those Muslims, voted for the Hamas candidates, not for the Fatah candidate, not for the PLO candidate, for Hamas, the most fundamentalist choice. What happened in Egypt the first time that people were actually allowed to vote? 70% voted for the most fundamentalist Muslim. Welcome back to Shattering This. The reality is that what is called the Arab Spring Revolts is a Islamic Reformation. Now, that's a really bad thing. And the reason it's a really bad thing is because fundamentalist Islam is the most evil, destructive curse perhaps ever perpetrated on humankind. It is the most adroitly satanic religion ever conceived. It is the most destructive and deadly religion ever conceived. And so, to reform it based upon its principles, based upon Muhammad's words and deeds, is amongst the most sinister things that can be done. A lot of this was precipitated by President Barack Hussein Obama, who went over to Cairo and gave a speech praising Islam, saying it was their time, that the United States would never fight them, that we would, in fact, embrace them. And they have risen up, and fundamentalist Islam has become the menace in the world that we are witnessing. It's responsible for 99% of the world's terrorist acts. And so here we're fighting a horrible menace. And Qatar is the primary supplier of weapons. If you look at what is happening in Syria, for example, it's a great window into how serious this problem is. In Syria, you had a peaceful protest of the Assad regime. The Sunni majority rightfully felt underrepresented. And Assad, like every other government in the Islamic world, is a dictator. Some of these dictators are elected, but as we mentioned before, when Muslims vote, their imams tell them that if you do not vote for the candidate that the mosque is recommending, Allah will see to it that you're killed and will attend to your torture in hell. And so here you have a protest, and it immediately turns into a proxy war. And it turned into a proxy war of Sunnis killing Shia because arms were initially supplied by Qatar. The same thing happened in Libya. If you want to know who's responsible for killing the American ambassador, yeah, the terrorist group was Ansar Sharia, Friends of Sharia Law. But the weapons were supplied by Qatar. But you can't just stop at Qatar and its emir, because the weapons that they are supplying aren't made there. They aren't manufacturers of weaponry. It's American weapons that are being distributed. And so the worst thing you could possibly do to those prone to killing in this mass a way is to provide them the means to kill more effectively. But that's what they have done. The other thing that was interesting about this opening statement, where it talks about providing weapons to those jihadists widely regarded as being, or just to rebels widely regarded as being jihadi militants, is that's all there is. That really is all there is, at least on the rebel side. The rebel side is comprised entirely of jihadists, of mujahideen, of fundamentalist Muslims. That's it. There is nobody else fighting on the rebel side. On the government side, you do have government troops that aren't jihadists. Although the most effective force on the government side is Hezbollah, which is also jihadi, mujahideen. It's very much like the case in Egypt, where there's only bad and worse. And it's, well, in the case of Syria, bad is the Assad regime. Far worse are the Sunni jihadists that are in opposition to it. This article continues, the tiny but wealthy gas-exporting country is under fire, under fierce pressure from some Gulf Arab neighbors to curb its support for Islamists of all stripes, particularly the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt and for more radical rebel groups with al-Qaeda ties in Syria. There's really no one in the Middle East other than Iran and Iran West, which is Iraq, Syria itself, which is opposed to Qatar supplying weapons to the jihadist terrorists in the Syrian war. They are all in lockstep in that regard. And at one time, they were all in lockstep when supporting the Muslim Brotherhood. Saudi Arabia supplied more money than Qatar did, as did Kuwait, when the Muslim Brotherhood won election. They were between very difficult choices in this regard. But at this point now, Saudi Arabia doesn't like Qatar supporting the Muslim Brotherhood.